Despite 71% of the Earth's surface being covered by the water, the UN World Water Development Report states 1 in 4 people in the world do not have access to clean drinking water. I'm Skynell Hughes, and on this edition of 360 View, we are going to examine why the UN is painting such a stark picture regarding the water supply in various regions and one scientist's vision to help efficiently solve the crisis. Let's get started. From tiny cyanobacteria to the largest mammal in the ocean, every organism needs water to survive. I am amazed in 2023, a year where technology allows many to control the daily functions of their house without even being home or having robots do brain surgery, one would think scientists could figure out how to make clean water available to all. Now, at the surface, water looks simple. And yet the complex and multifaceted levels of the global water crisis continues to create a situation where there is an inadequate supply of safe and clean water, which meets the need of a growing population. Now, here are some numbers for you, which I found to be shocking. 54% lack access to clean water in Niger, a country in Western Africa's desert region. Now, over on the island nation of Papua New Guinea, in the Pacific Ocean, 55% actually lack basic water services. 71% of Lebanon's population face critical water shortages, and the water crisis even exists in more developed countries. An estimated 2 million people do not have access to drinking water in the United States, with 1 million of them being in California. Now, in Europe, over 16 million people lack access to water capable of drinking, and 31 million need water for basic sanitation uses. So why has this problem not been fixed? Well, it's not about the money. Even though billions have been spent by governments all in the names of fixing the problems, and yet the problem continues to grow. For once, the lack of money isn't the problem. In fact, it costs less than what you think. The World Research Institute found that securing clean water for the entire globe by 2030 would cost just over 1% of the global GDP. It's only about 29 cents per person per day from 2015 to 2030. But the economic benefits outweigh the minimal cost, which invested in sanitation and water access would yield an average in $6.80 in returns. Failing to implement better policies for water management could lead to 2 to 10% GDP regional loss by 2015. So where is the money going? And what is the real reason behind a solution not being implemented? Well, luckily there are good people who are trying to earnestly find a solution, including our guest today, Seth M. Siegel, who is an American businessman, writer, and activist. He's the author of the 2015 New York Times bestseller, Let There Be Water, Israel's Solution for a Water-Starved World. He has also founded or co-founded several companies, including the Beanstalk Company and Six Point Partners. Thank you so much for joining us. What exactly classifies a water crisis?
You know, the real problem is not an official designation of a scientific designation. The problem begins when you start to have a public panic, when people begin to understand that water is giving out or that water is contaminated. And those are two separate phenomena, but they're linked. One is that water scarcity, the other one is water quality. But there are criteria, there's specific levels of acceptable, if you believe it or not, acceptable contamination that, in our drinking water. And there are also levels of acceptable drought. And because drought is hard to predict how far it's going to go and how long it's going to last, there's a whole level of drought warnings that are color-coded with red and bright red being being the very worst. In terms of drinking water, if you have contaminated water, unless it's a sudden outbreak of some bacteria, which comes with a boil alert, that tends to be something that is more systemic and something that, depending upon what the EPA code of behavior calls for, either requires further filtration or not, as the case may be. We can talk about that some more.
How much of this crisis is caused by the environment, or by government corruption or ineptness in planning?
The great thing about water problems are that they come at you slowly. I mean, I'm not talking about a water main break, but even that I'll explain in a second, doesn't come at you quick. Most water problems come at you very slowly, and it gives policymakers, government officials, regulators, and others lots of time to fix the problem, whether it's water scarcity or whether contamination, whether it's a water main that breaks. Generally, it's a pipe that you should have known long in advance needed to be replaced. So I don't like the word ineptitude because I don't love the idea of finger pointing, but let's just say that it means that government is not adequately incentivized to be focusing on water problems that can morph into water crises when they are not adequately addressed, at least soon enough. There's no reason why, absolutely no reason why globally we should be thinking of ourselves as being without water. There's enough water out there. It's a question of innovation. It's a question of technology. It's a question of will to move and jump over the problems that we have and fix them as we can with existing technologies.
Is there a reduction of surface water from the past? Or is there just a result of the growing world population and the lack of safe and secure drinking water?
The amount of water in the world today is, we like to say, is exactly the same amount of water as the time of the dinosaurs. It's a fixed amount, which never changes. What changes is the amount of water that is contaminated, either because it becomes seawater, clean water becoming seawater, or contaminated by human interaction, or by animals contaminating the water through their behavior, through eating and biological processes. So the amount of water doesn't change. As is fairly widely known, only a very tiny percentage of the global water, though, is fresh water, is unsalty water, about 3%, and about 2% of that about 2% of that gross amount is in the polar ice caps. So only 1% of global water is actually available for consumption, for agriculture, for cleaning our homes, for flushing our toilets, and so forth. Now, as populations rise, obviously, they need more food, and as people become more affluent, they change their diets, and the amount of food that they need to eat or want to eat tends to be ever more water consumptive. So population definitely has an impact on water supply. Economic development and economic prosperity definitely has an effect on water supply. Contamination has an effect on water supply. But the biggest user of water by far is agriculture. About 70 to 95% in every country. And therefore, by getting your handle on how you use your water for agriculture is how you're going to positively, absolutely, unquestionably give yourself, whether it's going to be a happy and good water future or a stressed water future. Climate change is playing an effect on this, of course, but not to the degree that we can't overcome it through the use of smart technology.
Is there a universal answer to the water crisis for every country? Or does this need to be more specialized based on the region? More importantly, who should be in charge of planning and implementing the plan?
Could you make it me? Could I be in charge of the entire world? I would like to do that. but if it's not going to be me, there are international bodies through the UN. There are bilateral treaties between countries that share waterways. There are multilateral treaties with multiple countries or multiple states that share waterways. Like, for example, in the U.S., the Colorado River is shared by 7 states, as well as the country of Mexico, and each of them has their own interests. So in the more advanced countries, there tends to be better systems in place for the sharing of water. But because of climate change, there's been a terrible series of decisions made, unilateral decisions made by some countries to take advantage of waters at the source that will have very dire impact on countries and communities downriver. So first I'll do internationally, and then I'll talk about the U.S. a little bit. But for example, if China is going to be damming the Indus River, which they have done, that is going to have a profound and very negative impact on Pakistan's water future. If Turkey is going to be damming the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, famous rivers, it's going to have a very, very bad outcome for the people of Iraq, for the people of Iran, also people of Syria. And these are countries that already are water stressed because of population growth, because of terrible mismanagement of water resources, back to your government ineptitude comment, and for other reasons. So the decision by individuals saying, "Ooh, we need more water and we're going to take it for ourselves," opens the door to all kinds of terrible outcomes downstream, downriver. Now, in the U.S., the Colorado River has been the source of a very long-term, 101-year-old set of rules called the Colorado River Compact, which governs how that water should be used. But likewise there, you know, states are looking out for their citizens, Mexico is looking out for its people, and it leads to all kinds of conflict that can and should be avoided by intelligent planning. I'll say just one more thing. The country of Egypt has long made very robust use of the Nile River. Well, Ethiopia, which is upstream of Egypt on the Nile, has made a decision to start damming the Nile for its own use, for its own water, for its agriculture, and for hydroelectricity. Now, that's going to have a very deep and profound impact on Egypt's future, with a population of about 110 million and growing very quickly, a lot of poverty, a very deep amount of agricultural use. About 95% of the fresh water there is used for agriculture. I predict very bad outcomes if the countries along the Nile River don't make a decision to start being smarter about how they use their water for agriculture. But if they do that, if they're able to do that, and if you can have, whether it's UN or the African Union or some other body to help mediate that water use, if you can have that, you can have a good outcome. If you don't, you can have a very bad outcome.
Thank you, Seth. Please stick around, because after the break, we're going to examine the various water quality challenges to the individual regions around the world. And you might be surprised who the biggest challenger has nothing to do with science.
Iranians, they are active very harshly against Israel. They operate a huge terror campaign because they have a strategy of, let's say, they want to gain hegemony in the Middle East. So Israel is, for them, the real Satan, and the big one is America, of course.
Y'all probably heard my little sister story, Kaylin, the model girl that had got killed. Y'all probably seen it all over the news on 7:30, man. She got shot in the drive-by shooting.
My brother Terrell, he was shot and killed while helping a friend unload drones into the church. So now I never look at churches as being a safe ground.
I got shot and lost my leg. That's the outcome of it, but everything's still the same. Ain't nothing changed.
The Chicago police is the biggest gang in Chicago. It's like, you get pulled over by police, you literally think your life is over, man.
That's another crime scene. Another one lost. Oh, this could have been a doctor, a nurse, could have been the next president. But we can't keep losing our people out here.
Welcome back. We're going to continue our discussion about the challenge to provide drinking water around the world with Seth M. Siegel. Now, Seth is an American businessman, writer, and activist. He is the author of the 2015 New York Times bestseller, Let There Be Water, Israel's Solution for a Water-Starved World. He's also founded or co-founded several companies, including the Beanstalk Group and Six Point Partners. Seth, you have pointed out how one of the smallest countries and one of the driest regions in the world is among those which have the best developed policies and techniques. Explain why you feel this way about what Israel is doing.
Well, first of all, it's totally feasible. I wrote a book about this topic. It's called Let There Be Water, Israel's Solution for a Water-Starved World. The book is actually, it's out a few years now, but it's still very much in print. It's now out in 24 languages, and it's been a bestseller in the U.S. and in many countries around the world, because people are concerned about water scarcity. And they are simultaneously amazed by what Israel has done to overcome that water scarcity. Israel is in the driest region of the world. Israel has the fastest growing rate of population over the past 75 years since Israel was founded as a state of any country in the world. Israel is the fastest growing population. After Singapore and South Korea, it is the third, it is the fastest growing economy in the world. And Israel has suffered terribly from climate change, losing about 25% or so of its average annual rainfall. And yet, despite all that, despite going from about 800,000 people to about 9.4 million people in that time period, Israelis today enjoy robust amounts of water, as if they're living in New York or London. There's all the water people need because people are careful with the water. And Israel is so water abundant that they provide water every single day for the people of Gaza. Even when the rockets are flying out of Gaza, Israel is pumping water into Gaza. About 60% of the household water use in the West Bank comes from Israeli sources, and Israel also exports water to the Kingdom of Jordan. So how do they do all that? They did it because of thinking about water issues for a long time, developing a water-revering culture, having smart, very smart governance, apolitical governments, getting politics out of the application of how you use water, using market forces, charging the real cost of water, and copious, enormous amounts of technology permeating every part of the Israeli water story, which is why every drop is utilized efficiently and frequently multiple times. So in that regard, not every country is like Israel. Israel has a long sea coast, so they can do desalination. But not every country is like Israel. But whether rich or poor, whether landlocked or adjacent to waterways, every country can learn from Israel in terms of its focus on water and what it does. And I hasten to add, by the way, that thousands and thousands of water officials, government officials, corporate executives, and others come to Israel every year to learn what Israel has done in water so that they can take that message back to their countries or companies or communities or regions or societies and utilize some of the Israeli methodology in what they are doing themselves. It's really quite an extraordinary story of how this small country, which is oftentimes beleaguered from a security point of view, was able to create this robust water society.
Okay, so let us move east, where there is a major issue regarding water contamination, like what is happening in India, where around 200,000 habitations in the country reported to have poor water quality, posing serious health risks to the population. Now, what's interesting is this is nothing new. It's not a new problem in India. Therefore, what are leaders doing so that they can find a solution? What more should they be doing?
Yeah, the problem is pricing. In India, they basically give away the water. They charge, you know, a few rupees, a few pennies for large amounts of water. And because of the fact that they are giving away the water, there's no sense of conservation on the one hand, and also there's no money available to fix the water system. So the system leaks greatly. You lose sometimes as much as 60 to 65% of the water coursing through the system is lost to leaks, which is crazy but true. Not always the case, but almost universally, over 30% of the water is lost to leaks. And simultaneously, the water supply is contaminated because of a lack of regulation that protects from dumping into those rivers you made reference to, dumping of chemicals from factories, dumping of animal waste, and so forth. And that creates a crisis in many, many, many communities. By the way, in the U.S., I wrote another book about this. I wrote a book called Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink. And in Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink, I highlight, even in the United States, that we are not exactly perfect in terms of providing water quality where we can. And you may think, oh, it's just limited to Flint, Michigan, but that's not true. We have contaminated water, different levels of contamination, very, very, very widely throughout the United States, except that the EPA has set standards that say this is what you're allowed to be contaminated up to this level. And people are drinking water thinking it's healthy when it's legal, but it's not necessarily safe. And there's a big difference with drinking water, whether it's legal water or safe water. Now, there are times, as in India, as in the U.S., where it exceeds the legal standard and it's actually a health hazard. But that comes down to whether or not there is the will and the wallet to fix the water problems. When you have other problems that you prioritize over water, over time, you're going to have a very bad water outcome.
Since we are looking at various regions around the globe, I want to ask you about South America. You know, Brazil is another country I was astonished to read about. The country is home to the mighty Amazon River and tropical landscapes. And yet some 30 million people, just under 15% of the population, all lack access to reliable and safe drinking water. Again, what is going on in Brazil and what is the solution?
Yeah, so it's not surprising if you look at a map. And the reason I say that is because where there are great quantities of fresh water, like the Amazon or Hudson Bay up in Canada, there are actually very few people. So where you can match the amount of water with large population centers, say like Lake Michigan, where Chicago or Milwaukee are right on the shoreline, then you have a good match between fresh water supply and population. But frequently what you have is you have population that has developed in areas where it's water adequate for the first development, and then populations keep growing and you don't have adequate water for that, and so water scarcity becomes ever more a problem. Now, I've been to Brazil, I've lectured in Brazil. The problem about Brazil also is that you have these slum called favelas, you have these slum areas that can easily have their water problems fixed. It's in the slum areas where you have these great amounts of contaminated water that people are drinking. Now, what you should be doing, what they could be doing and should be doing, is capturing all of the sewage of their community and then using existing technology, not very fancy, not very sophisticated technology, treating it to an ultra-high pure level and returning it as called potable reuse, as reusable drinking water. Or if that's too gross for people, reusing the water for local agriculture. Either of those works fine. In Israel, they don't do direct potable reuse. They treat all the water. They, by far, the greatest capture of sewage in the world is in Israel. And they treat about 85% of the national sewage, and then they use it exclusively for agriculture. In some parts of California and Arizona, they capture the water, treat it, and reuse it for drinking water. Either of those are adequate and fine. It's mostly a psychological issue, not a health issue. But when you are just going to leave things to chance and not supply water to your communities, you're going to end up with both contaminated water and with inadequate amounts of water. I hasten to add one more thing. In the last century, in California and the Southwest, decisions were made to divert waterways so that there'll be adequate amounts of water for growing communities in the Southwest and California. So that's a big infrastructure project. It's expensive. Not every country can afford that. But every country can afford to take their sewage and treat it and reuse it. And that's something that I am a strong advocate for. And if you're between the two, where you have some money but not fortunes of money, you also can choose to desalinate water if you are nearby an ocean or a sea. You can do the same thing there and get plenty of high quality, very, very safe drinking water for your populations.
Finally, North Africa. Now, this is right in the backyard of Israel, which we just spoke about. The region is remarkably arid and lacks reliable freshwater resources. About 90% of children in this region actually live in areas considered water stress. What can be done here, practically speaking, when the problem seems so universal? Is this an actual emergency?
Well, there are certainly some parts of North Africa that are in dire stress. There are certainly parts of other countries that are in dire stress as well right now. We still have a little bit of time, but not a lot. And the choices there are either engineering programs to divert the existing waterways that are adequate to provide water, like the Nile for Sudan and for Egypt. There are also North Africa, of course, abuts the Mediterranean Sea. So in most of the large cities of North Africa, whether it's Libya or Algeria or Morocco or Tunisia, most of them are close enough to the Mediterranean that they could be desalinating water and making use of it that way. All of them are producing, of course, sewage on a daily basis. They could be capturing that water and treating it. So when people have bad water outcomes, sometimes it's because of climate change, sometimes it's because of population growth, but almost always it's because of an inadequate attention to detail far enough in advance to start thinking about how you can fix your water for yourself and possibly for your neighbors. Israel, which you just mentioned, is not a miracle, because miracles come from God, I suppose, but it's something of a phenomenon because of the fact that so many people in the country for so long, over 100 years now, have been thinking about water, have been spending large amounts of their government resources around water and so forth. I'd like to share a short story, if I may, which is that when my book, Let There Be Water, came out in Hebrew, I came for the publishing launch there. And much to my delight, I was invited to come to the prime minister's office to sit with the prime minister. Now, I already knew from my research that the first prime minister of Israel, whose diaries I read, was doing some of my historical research for the book Let There Be Water, was thought about water on a daily basis because his diary was just filled with comments about water projects and water worries and so forth. And likewise, the third prime minister of Israel, Levi Eshkol, had been the head of the National Water Authority. And he obviously was deeply concerned about water issues. But what he was not expecting was some 70 years after the founding of the state to have the current prime minister, who was Benjamin Netanyahu, who was still the prime minister, would be so sophisticated about water issues. I come to his office. I thought it'd be a quick photo op. Hello, goodbye. And indeed, he sat me down. We spoke for 45 minutes. And a lot of that time was him talking about his insights into what Israel was doing in water and what they could do more of. Now, I've traveled all over the world, and I must say I've never had an experience like that with another head of state. Even when I testified before agriculture and environmental committees at the parliaments and legislatures around the world, I've not seen the same level of sophistication. And it's because of that attention to the issue that Israel is where it is. And if we get more focus on water issues, more people thinking about it, more university courses about it, more public officials dealing with it, more media doing this, as you're doing today, then you're going to have a very different outcome about our water future. We can have a very good water future if we will just focus on the issue.
Well, thank you, Seth M. Siegel, for all of the work you are doing to help fix this problem around the world. Now, in order to address the complex and urgent global water crisis, there needs to be a combination of policy changes, technological advancement, and most importantly, a willing government body on the local, national, and of course, global levels, all working together. It is crucial everyone works to ensure an equitable and sustainable water future for everyone in the present, or else no one is guaranteed clean water in the future. I'm Skynell Hughes, and this has been your 360 view of the news affecting you. Thanks for watching.